Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, America's longest war comes to a close. After 20 years, the United States has finally pulled out of Afghanistan. But it was not the orderly withdrawal President Biden had hoped for, the takeover by the Taliban, the chaos at the Kabul airport, the ISIS-K attack that killed both Afghans and U.S. service members left Americans in shock, many asking, how could this happen? Craig Whitlock is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post and author of the new book, The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. In it, he recounts how Afghanistan became such a quagmire and how the American government misled the public about the situation on the ground. Craig Whitlock joined me Thursday morning. Craig, the war in Afghanistan is now officially over. Many Americans were so shocked at what happened. It wasn't the orderly exit that everyone expected. Why was there such a disconnect between what we thought was going to happen and what actually happened?
Well, that's a really good question, and it may take some time to sort out. But in terms of the Biden administration, you know, they clearly thought that the Afghan government would be able to remain in power, at least in Kabul, for at least a few months. And they were expecting that they'd be able to hang on and there'd be a longer transition period. I think in some ways, though, we were lulled to sleep a little bit by the last big withdrawal from a war, which was in Iraq in 2011. At that time, I was actually in Baghdad for the final U.S. troops to withdraw. And the general in charge was Secretary Austin, who's now the defense secretary. He was the general in charge of the withdrawal from Iraq. And that was a very orderly affair, right? There was a ceremony at the military base in Baghdad. There were no evacuations or flights or panic or anything like that. And I do wonder if maybe the Biden administration, because we have some of the same people were involved in that episode, kind of were expecting the something similar in Kabul. Whereas, of course, they completely miscalculated about the will of the Afghan army to fight and the will of the Afghan government under President Ashraf Ghani to stay in power.
And I guess the question is, how could that miscalculation have been so huge? Weren't there doubts? Weren't there naysayers? Weren't there those who were saying you could see total mayhem?
There were many naysayers going back for the duration of the war. I mean, really, our whole strategy for the withdrawal and for ending the war hinged on trying to build up an Afghan army and an Afghan paramilitary police force that could defend their own government, that could defend their own country against the Taliban. And in public for 20 years, you know, U.S. generals and presidents and other officials told the American public that this project was going well, that there were a lot of challenges, but that the Afghan army was coming along and that this was a competent fighting force that would defend their country. But there were so many reports internally from U.S. military trainers and others who were warning that, no, the Afghan army is not competent. They can't shoot straight. They consist of illiterate, unmotivated recruits with corrupt commanders. And that looking back, it's clear that, you know, not only should we have known that this army might fall apart, but we should have expected it.
Did we actually expect it? Was the military in charge of U.S. and Afghan forces lying to the American people about what that Afghan army really looked like?
Yes, I think they were lying, and I don't use that word lightly. In the Afghanistan papers in my book, we document very clearly all these episodes and interviews that U.S. military officials had conducted over the years in which their assessments of the Afghan army and police were very, very poor. And yet in public, of course, U.S. generals would keep assuring that things were on track. And there were multiple warnings. This all the way back to the Bush administration, you know, under Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, he would assure the public that the Afghan army was making progress. And yet he was receiving personally these blistering reports from his own chain of command saying that, you know, we'd be lucky if they would improve over the next 20 years and that they were corrupt and that it was this house of horrors. So they knew, Rumsfeld, but also the Obama administration and the Trump administration, that the Afghan army was not going to hold for long. I just think the Biden administration thought they had more time than they did.
So why, if you can figure it out, why would Rumsfeld and all those in charge during the Bush administration continue this false facade?
Well, you know, there's a cliche that truth is the first casualty of war. And so honest reporting often goes out the window. But I think in the case of Afghanistan, that's something I've tried to wrestle with. Why were they not telling the truth all along? And I think it goes back to the roots of this conflict, at least in terms of the U.S. involvement. You have to remember in 2001, this war was seen as a just cause. It had the support of the vast majority of the American people who saw it as a war of self-defense because of what happened on September 11th, and that we were justified to go to Afghanistan to try and destroy al-Qaeda to make sure there weren't more terrorist attacks. So, and the American people thought we had won this war within this first 6 months. The Taliban had been removed from power and al-Qaeda's leadership had been captured or killed or had fled Afghanistan. So from that perspective, if you're a U.S. president or the generals at the Pentagon, who wants to admit that they're slowly losing a war that the American people thought we had won and thought was a just cause? Nobody wants to admit failure. Nobody wants to admit that they weren't capable of maintaining this victory that it seemed at first. So I think people just kept digging a deeper and deeper hole rather than level with the American people that slowly this had become an unwinnable conflict in terms of the United States involvement.
So how did you get all the material that you got for this book?
Well, sort of the old-fashioned way. It just took a lot of digging and a lot of patience. Long story short, the Washington Post had to file two Freedom of Information Act lawsuits against the federal government to obtain hundreds of confidential interviews that people who were involved in the war had conducted with an agency called the Special Inspector for Afghanistan. If I was a better reporter, I would have gotten somebody to leak them to me sooner, but I wasn't able to do that. And so we had to go to court, and it took 3 years of hiring lawyers and fighting in the courts to get this material. But it was clear to us that this was, the public had such a strong interest in this material because they were really confessions from generals and ambassadors and White House officials of just all the mistakes that were made over 20 years and how, quite simply, the United States didn't know what it was doing in Afghanistan. And, to me, it's sort of a crime that the government covered this up and kept these assessments from the public. If they had maybe had this honest conversation a long time ago, I think the war would have been shortened. We wouldn't have had to be there for 20 years.
I was surprised to see the name Michael Flynn emerge here. Tell me what role he played.
Sure. So today, most people know Michael Flynn for his politics. He's embraced QAnon and a lot of these conspiracy theories. But, for most of his career, he was in the United States Army, and he became a three-star general in charge of military intelligence. He was overseeing military intelligence in Afghanistan for the United States and NATO during the Obama administration. And at that time, he was very highly respected within the armed forces, that he was very, that he spoke very bluntly, and he wouldn't engage in all this happy talk that a lot of the other U.S. officials did. So that's how this whole project got started. In 2016, I heard that Flynn had given an interview that was part of the Afghanistan papers in which he was very critical about how the war had been fought and in particular how it had been presented to the American people. he, at that point, was just becoming known for his support of Donald Trump. So he was in the news. I wanted to see what he said. This was part of the lawsuit the Post filed against the government. We finally obtained Flynn's transcript of what Flynn said. And in contrast with today, where he says a lot of crazy things, back then, his assessments were really on the mark. He kept saying, you know, every measurement from the field, from headquarters in Kabul, show that we're not winning this war, that we're losing. You know, all our commanders say it feels like we're losing slowly. So how come we keep telling the American people that we're winning? So, you know, the irony here is, here's Michael Flynn, who's got a dubious reputation these days, but back then he was one of the few who was actually telling the truth about how things were going.
What were the generals themselves saying to each other?
Well, again, in these interviews we obtained confidentially, they were telling the government that things were a disaster. I was shocked when I read one interview in particular with a general named Dan McNeil. He was the war commander in Afghanistan twice under Bush, two different occasions. And he said, we didn't have a strategy. We didn't have a campaign plan. I was just told to go over there and kill terrorists. But there was no plan. And I was shocked. I was like, what general admits he doesn't have a strategy, right? I mean, it's one thing to say in retrospect, the strategy was mistaken or we made errors, but he just said we just were on autopilot fighting this war. I thought maybe it was hyperbole on his point, but then there was another interview transcript with a British general, David Richards, who oversaw US and NATO troops in 2006 and 2007. And he said the same thing. He said, we didn't have a strategy. We had a lot of tactics, but we didn't have a coherent strategy. And when you hear multiple generals saying we didn't have a coherent strategy, that makes your eyebrows shoot up. But again, this is such a contrast with what they were saying in public, which was that they were making progress, we were turning the corner, and they promised victory. And yet in private, they said things were just a mess.
And what was their goal in staying there?
That's another really simple question, but there's no good answer for it. And the problem is, as you see in interview after interview in the Afghanistan papers, they said at first the mission was clear. The objectives were clear. They were very modest, which was, we want to eliminate Al-Qaeda as a threat to the United States. But again, that goal was accomplished within 6 months. By March of 2002, there was no Al-Qaeda presence left in Afghanistan, or very minimal. But that's when mission creep started to set in, and it was just sort of fuzzy as how long were we going to stay? The purpose was to try and build up an Afghan government that could defend itself, but there was never any clear consensus or objectives laid out about exactly what we were trying to accomplish.
What would have happened if we had simply left in 2002? Wouldn't Afghanistan have gone back to control by the Taliban and all the other bad folks operating there?
Well, that was the fear, that Afghanistan would lapse back into civil war, that you would have all these factions, the warlords, the Taliban would, you know, that there would be this security vacuum, and that the problems that had plagued the country ever since the Soviet invasion of 1979 would just come roaring back. So that was part of why we stayed. And it's understandable that we stayed at that point, trying to stabilize the country. But the problem was there was never any real resolution or even discussion of, you know, how will we know when we've done the job? You know, at what point can we leave? You know, how strong does the Afghan government need to be? How many, quote unquote, terrorists do we need to hunt down and capture? It just was kind of left to drift. And the biggest problem was immediately in 2002, the Bush administration pivoted and started spending all its focus and attention on Iraq and planning for the invasion of Iraq. And so Afghanistan was just kind of put on the back burner.
So had we not gone into Iraq, do you think the outcome in Afghanistan might have been different?
Yes, I do. And there's no guarantee. Afghanistan had enormous problems and challenges and needs, but if there was ever a time when we could have really made a difference in strengthening the Afghan institutions, giving humanitarian aid and trying to put the country on its feet, that time was during Bush's first term, when instead we spent all our attention and focus on Iraq. You know, the best example of this, of losing our focus, it can be found in a memo that Donald Rumsfeld wrote just a year into the war in 2002. He was recounting in this memo how he had gone to the Oval Office to meet President Bush. And he told Bush, I have two generals in town this week. There's General Tommy Franks, who's the commander of forces in the Middle East, who is overseeing the war plans for Iraq, and General Dan McNeil. And he asked the president, you know, can I set up a meeting for you with General Franks and General McNeil? And Bush said, yeah, Tommy Franks, I want to meet with him, because, of course, he wanted to talk about Iraq. But who's General McNeil? And Rumsfeld said, well, sir, he's the commander of the war in Afghanistan. And Bush said, oh, well, I don't need to meet with him. So there you have it, right? The president is completely focused on Iraq, doesn't want to spend any time on Afghanistan, doesn't even know who his top general is there. And to me, that sort of said it all.
And now, 20 years later, remind us of the cost of this war in terms of money and lives.
Well, the costs are still going up and up. About 2,400 U.S. military service members have lost their lives in the war. Probably more than 70 or 80,000 were wounded there. Another 1,100 NATO allies and troops were killed in Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of Afghan civilians, tens of thousands of Afghan soldiers and police. And of course, the Taliban has taken heavy losses. So we don't have a precise accounting or numbers of how many Afghans have lost their lives, unfortunately, but the number of Afghan civilians getting killed kept going up and up each year. So even as the U.S. started to withdraw, the number of civilians getting killed was getting worse and worse up until the end. We've also spent over $1 trillion so far, but when you include the indirect costs like debt payments and health care for veterans and things like that, the estimates are that the war will have cost us about $2 trillion. And in the end, there's, of course, very, very little to show for it, with the Taliban now back in charge. The Taliban's stronger now than it was back in 2001. And there are concerns about whether Al-Qaeda or other affiliates could come back to Afghanistan.
What's so fascinating to me is, of course, the U.S. had seen the history of Russia in Afghanistan finally giving up because Afghanistan was such a complex situation. Do you think the U.S. did not understand that right from the beginning?
No, they did understand that from the beginning, and we know this. They just, how do I say it? The lesson was right in front of our faces, and we knew about it, but we didn't pay heed for very long. There's a good example of this. In April of 2002, so again, just 6 months into the war, President Bush gave a speech at the Virginia Military Institute, and he addressed this very topic. He said, we've seen what happened with Russia and the British going into Afghanistan as these foreign powers, and they got bogged down, and it looks like initial success militarily, but then they founder around and they can't get out. And he said, we're not going to let that happen to us. We're not going to repeat that mistake. So he knew about the lesson, but it happened anyway. But that story has a coda to it. On the very same day that Bush was giving his speech saying we learned our lessons, Rumsfeld was dictating a memo to some of his top generals and civilian aides in which he was saying, I'm really worried if we don't come up with a plan to stabilize Afghanistan, we're never going to get our troops out. We need to come up with a plan. And the last word of the memo was a single word. It said, help, exclamation point. So again, in public, the president's expressing all this confidence and saying, we're not going to let this happen to us, what happened to the Russians. But in private, on that very same day, his defense secretary is worried about that precise scenario.
You must have been utterly shocked reading these papers.
I was sometimes just the bluntness of some of the admissions. You know, I think most Americans, obviously, we knew the war hadn't been going well for a long time. If a war drags on for 20 years, by definition, it's not going very well, especially if it's a war that your side started. But when you always sort of assume there's a plan that maybe it went off the rails, but there was some kind of plan that people thought they knew what they were doing. But in some of these interviews, you know, very senior people just admitted they didn't know what they were doing. There was one interview with a three-star Army general named Doug Lute, who has worked in the White House under Bush and Obama. He was known as the war czar, so he was administratively overseeing strategy in the war in Afghanistan. And he was very blunt. He said, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing." Then there was another interview with an ambassador named Richard Boucher, who was the senior U.S. diplomat overseeing South Asia during the Bush administration. And he said the same thing, and I'm quoting, he says, "We didn't know what we were doing." So when you see these people in charge admitting, frankly, that literally they didn't know what they were doing, it was a shock. You never expect people to admit that, but that's how bad things were. They were worse than any of us knew.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Craig Whitlock.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Craig Whitlock. He is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post and author of The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. There was a point where President Obama tried to get out. What happened?
Right. Obama, Trump, and Biden all tried to get out, and only Biden could pull it off. But Obama had promised to pull out all U.S. troops by the end of his second term in 2016, and he was close to doing so. In December of 2014, so 7 years ago now, there was a ceremony in Kabul at military headquarters where the generals in charge and Obama put out a statement saying, "We're ending the combat mission in Afghanistan. You know, U.S. troops are no longer going to be involved in the fight." And Obama said, in a statement, he said, "We're bringing the war in Afghanistan to a responsible conclusion." So he was sending this message, we're ending the war, even though there were going to be a few thousand U.S. troops remaining there to advise the Afghan army. But really, none of this was true. The combat mission didn't end. There were still U.S. troops involved in combat. We were still conducting thousands of airstrikes and bombings a year. We were getting involved in firefights on the ground. More than 100 U.S. troops died in combat after Obama made that announcement. And the reason for this was, you know, Obama wanted to pull out of the war, but the fear was if we did, the Afghan state would collapse, that the Taliban would take over. So even back 7 years ago, there was this fear that we couldn't rely on the Afghan army to defend its own country, and so we had to stay. But really, he was just putting off the decision that Trump also had to deal with, and Biden too, was, we can't leave because we're worried our allies will fall apart, so we have to stay. But the longer we stayed, the weaker the Afghan government became, and the Taliban only grew stronger. So we kept kicking the can down the road, but the situation only kept growing worse and worse by the year.
And what about President Trump? What was his effort?
So Trump had promised clearly when he ran for office and when he was president that he would end the war. And like Trump does, he said things in very black and white sentences, making these promises. And I think he did try. He clearly wanted to pull troops out. And his administration cut a deal with the Taliban to withdraw all U.S. forces by May of this year. Of course, he didn't do this while he was still in office, he left it to Biden. But if you look at Trump's policy, it was kind of all over the place. On one hand, he's promising to end the war, but then a year into his term, he actually accelerated it. He put more troops back in Afghanistan and greatly escalated the bombing campaign. So the number of airstrikes and bombs that were dropped in Afghanistan was more intense and more frequent under Trump than even at the height of the war under Obama. But this was mostly unseen to the American people because it was an air war and we didn't have much television coverage of it. And so people really lost sight of the fact that the war actually intensified under Trump. I think he was trying to pressure the Taliban into negotiations, but it was kind of this, you know, this flailing around strategy that didn't have much point to it. And so in the end, he kind of scaled back and tried to pull out, but he left it to Biden to finish it off.
So in Tuesday's speech, President Biden implied that the actions of the Trump administration essentially tied his, President Biden's, hands and committed him to this withdrawal. Is that true?
Well, no. Biden could have made his own deal or made his own decisions. He wasn't bound by anything. But again, the irony here is I think Biden and Trump wanted the same thing. They both wanted to pull out of Afghanistan, but it's a lot easier to start a war than it is to end one. And so they knew things were going to get ugly or that this wasn't going to be smooth. And so it was very difficult to find a way to pull out U.S. troops without violence and trying to keep the Afghan government in place. So I think, there's a lot of finger pointing going on, right? But really, the last three presidents all tried to end the war. Both Obama and Trump couldn't bring themselves quite to do it because they were worried the Afghan government might collapse. In hindsight, their fears were right. The Afghan government did collapse. But, you know, Biden, I mean, if he wanted to, he could have escalated the war again. He could have sent in U.S. troops. I don't think he had any great choices here. And he wanted to get out. But the fact, you know, this idea that he was bound by Trump just isn't true. He could have gone in whatever direction he wanted.
So you've got Bush, you've got Obama, you've got Trump, and now you've got Biden. Who's going to get the blame/credit for getting us out of Afghanistan?
Well, I think clearly President Biden. I mean, he'll you know, the good and bad of it. He finally ended the war. The others wanted to and couldn't. He brought the U.S. troops home, but he also has to take responsibility for how it unfolded and the good and the bad. And there was a lot of both. I mean, on one hand, you know, it was remarkable that the U.S. military was able to evacuate as many people as they did on very short notice. That's not an easy operation. And you think about the risks involved. Here they are in Kabul with the Taliban, their enemy for so many years, in control of the city, and they're trying to evacuate, you know, more than 100,000 civilians. They were very fortunate there wasn't open warfare in Kabul. At the same time, you have threats from terrorist groups like the Islamic State, which was responsible for that awful suicide bombing that killed 13 U.S. service members and more than 100 Afghans outside the airport. So, look, it was a bad, chaotic situation. But to me, as somebody who covered the military for many years, it could have been far worse. It was clear the Biden administration hadn't planned well for it. But, you know, we're really fortunate that the loss of life wasn't greater. There could have been a plane shot down. There could have been more bombings. We could have had shootouts with the Taliban for days on end. So I think in the end, the Biden administration was fortunate. But you're right. Biden's going to, historically, he'll be the one president who said, I ended the war, an unpopular war. But he also has to take responsibility for how that unfolded.
So how could it have been done in a better way?
Well, this is 2020 hindsight, but Obama clearly he promised to end the war and promised to withdraw U.S. troops. But if he had stuck with his original plan to pull out U.S. troops by the end of his second term, at that point, the Afghan government was stronger and the Taliban was weaker. Now, maybe in the end, the Taliban still would have taken over, but I think the evacuation could have unfolded in a more orderly fashion. You know, the plan was to hand over responsibility for all security to the Afghan army and police during Obama's term. And if he had truly done that and pulled out U.S. troops, things would have been a lot smoother. You know, who knows how long the Afghan government would have remained in power, but that would have been on them, and the U.S. wouldn't have had this direct involvement. So in retrospect, that was the clear time to do it. You know, they ended up just postponing for 7 years the inevitable, which was that the Taliban were going to come back into power.
So what do you think could happen now that the Taliban is in charge, the U.S. is gone? What does the Taliban want from the U.S. in order to keep Afghanistan quiet?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating situation. So here's the enemy we've been fighting for the better part of two decades, yet the Taliban would like nothing more at this point than to have diplomatic recognition from the United States. They had asked the Biden administration to keep the embassy open because they want humanitarian aid and economic aid to keep flowing to the country. Afghanistan is the economy is highly dependent on U.S. aid and aid from other donor countries. And if the U.S. turns off the taps to that, the Afghan economy could collapse. And the Taliban's very cognizant of this, and they want support and help from the U.S. government. There's also interesting cooperation going on counterterrorism. You may recall the CIA director, William Burns, recently flew into Kabul and met with the Taliban leadership. And clearly they were discussing, among other things, whether the Taliban and U.S. intelligence could work together against groups like Islamic State in Afghanistan. Islamic State's a terrorist group that is hostile toward the Taliban. They think the Taliban, believe it or not, is too moderate and not pure enough, and the Taliban is fighting Islamic State. So this could be a situation where the U.S. and the Taliban actually work together on security issues. But if the U.S. is going to recognize the Taliban, obviously, then, you know, that's a bitter pill to swallow. That's saying that this movement that has very brutal attitudes toward women and their human rights record is abysmal, we're essentially accepting that, at least tacitly, if we're going to recognize them. But, you know, this is a difficult decision the Biden administration is going to have to wrestle with. To what degree can we work with the Taliban? To what degree do we want to work with the Taliban? But the reality is they're in charge. And in some ways, I think Biden hopes the Taliban can at least bring some stability to Afghanistan that's been missing for the better part of 40 years there.
They've promised to allow women to go to school, to have jobs, to drive cars. If they do not keep those promises and continue to terrorize women, is the U.S. going to continue to support them?
Well, this is the situation, right? You know, and that's the question. I don't know, but I'm not too hopeful that the Taliban all of a sudden is going to adopt progressive ideals and let women keep doing all that. I mean, to give you one example, they already announced that they're reimposing their ban on music, right, in Afghanistan. So that doesn't give you much sense that they've evolved into the 21st century. But this is the dilemma the Biden administration faces. This is not a movement or a government that shares any American values, but from a security standpoint, do we cooperate with them or not?
Do we know how many Americans have been left behind?
The State Department has said more than about 100 Americans, somewhere between 100 and 200. Now, I don't have insight in exactly who these people are, but I think a number of them are dual citizens or people who have U.S. citizenship, but they also have family members there who are Afghan and don't have U.S. citizenship. I clearly a number of them still want to come out, and I don't know how long that's going to take or how that's going to work. That's going to be very difficult. But the numbers that the State Department has given has been between 100 and 200 U.S. citizens still there.
Craig, finally, the report your book is based on was called Lessons Learned. Looking back, Are there lessons that the U.S. can learn from Afghanistan?
Absolutely. Now, whether we absorb those lessons is another question, but the lessons are pretty clear there in the sense that in all these interviews that we obtained and most of the documents, a running theme is that, you know, we bit off more than we can chew, that there was a real element of hubris here in that U.S. officials thought they could really transform Afghanistan, a country that we didn't know, we didn't understand very well, this country halfway around the world, yet it was almost this arrogance that we thought we could turn it into a modern society, we could build up an army from scratch, impose democracy, and make our way of life work there. And, you know, we really didn't understand this country. And, you know, we had these grandiose expectations that we should have scaled way back. So that's one obvious lesson. The other one, frankly, is even though we knew that Afghanistan has a history of resisting foreign occupiers like they did with the Soviets and the British, somehow we still thought it was a good idea to stay there with our troops for 20 years. And in the end, even many Afghans who didn't support the Taliban, who hated the Taliban, you know, they also came to resent the presence of U.S. troops. They, you know, there were so many airstrikes that went awry that killed so many civilians, and people there are just tired of war, and they wanted the U.S. military to leave. They want an end to the fighting. They want peace. They want stability. And I think we just underestimated that very obvious lesson. We never really learned it, that if you stay in another country for that long, there's going to be resentment that's going to be inevitable, even from people who you would think would be your allies.
Craig Whitlock, thank you for your reporting and for this book.
Of course, Diane, always great talking to you, and thanks very much.
That was Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter at The Washington Post. He's author of the new book titled The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. So good to be back with you. I'm Diane Rehm.